we're waiting on the board. So we'll go ahead and call meeting to order for our scheduled Planning and Zoning Commission meeting. Stephanie, can you, I know that we anticipate more members showing up, but we have a crowd and we have a quorum, so we'll go ahead and get started. Can you roll call?
McBride.
Here.
Moss, absent. Moore, absent. Smith.
Here.
Mins.
Here.
Sherwood.
Here.
Cable, absent.
Are there any items to be brought before the board that, before the commission that are not already on the agenda? Anything that we need to amend the agenda? All right, hearing none, then we'll approve the agenda as it stands. Are there any proposed changes, or how can I word this? We need to approve the minutes from the last meeting, so we'll have a voice vote confirmation. All those in favor of approving the minutes as they are, say aye.
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 I have to abstain.
You weren't here. All right. So record shows that Sherwood abstained since he was absent.
Oh, God, I don't think I was here either.
Well, there we go. Okay. All right, so now is the opportunity for public comment about any items that are not on the agenda to be covered today. Seeing none, we will continue. We will start. One announcement. If you are here, if you have not signed in, please sign in so that we, just as a matter of record, have who's in attendance. So let's go ahead and begin with the public hearing portion of the meeting with a discussion about CUP 5-19. Record shows Moss is also over here.
Before I start, I'd just like to introduce most of the commission did meet our new planner, Marcus Amon. He's from the Southern Iowa Council of Governments, and he just started last week. And it's a good thing because we're very, very busy, and Marcus has helped pick up the slack. So we're very happy that he's joined us.
Welcome.
So this first item is CUP 05-19. It's Story County Wind 1. And it's a project that involves conversion of 100 existing wind energy conversion systems. So we're dealing with multiple property owners, Northeast Story County. The existing systems are located in Warren, Lincoln, Sherman townships, primarily A1 agricultural district zoning. The land use for the most part is agricultural row crop with, of course, the wind energy conversion systems. C2C plan map designation is agricultural conservation area. Cities within 2 miles of the proposed project are McCallsburg, Zering, and Colo. The utilities that have service in this area are Consumers Energy, Midland Power, and Alliant Energy. So again, the project is Story Wind. The corporate headquarters is 700 Universe Boulevard, Juneau, Florida. Again, they're proposing to change out the existing rotors and the hub assembly components of the 100 existing systems. So it's a request to change the 77-meter rotors. The current components have GE 1.5 megawatt components. They're proposing to change out 50 of those to 87-meter rotors with 1.62 megawatt service, and then 50, the remaining half will be 91 meter rotor blades at 1.62 total megawatt service. The structural tower and the foundations will remain in place, that will not be changed. So the height that we're dealing with for the 91 meter rotors is approximately 412 feet. The height for the 87-foot-high rotor is about 405 feet from grade to tip of rotor. Proposed laydown yard to store equipment and supplies associated with the project will be located on a 38-acre parcel in the southwest corner of 180th Street and 720th Avenue. They're looking at approximately 10 acres of that 38 acres for this laydown yard. And again, this is a temporary use for this project. Current operations and maintenance building is just south of the proposed laydown yard area on a 13-acre parcel, address 18327 720th Avenue, again, directly south. So again, we're in three townships. They're outlined in red. You got Warren to the northwest. To the east of that is Lincoln Township. And then to the south of that is Sherwin. Total of three. This shows you the outline of the project area. We'll zoom in. But this is like a two-mile boundary. The green line represents like a two-mile boundary from the limits of the actual project area. This is the detail. If you look in, maybe hard to see on this map, but in the upper northwest corner, unit number one, it goes all the way through to unit 100 down in the southeast corner of the project area. So the schedule is July of this year for to begin site preparation, delivery of materials, supplies, again, July. And then they would plan to begin operations in November of this year. So the benefits of the project that were provided by the applicant are to improve efficiency of the turbine operation, extend landowner payments. They've indicated that they've made around $5 million in annual landowner lease payments since 2005. And then, of course, the property tax revenue, $12.1 million generated. Total project cost, around $122 million. The previous conditional use for this project was approved by the Board of Adjustment October 3 of 2007. So it's been in effect for about 10 years. And again, that was for the entire 100 units that were eventually constructed. Surrounding land use, for the most part, is predominantly agricultural row crop. With the inclusion of the wind energy systems, single-family dwellings, and then farmsteads. FAA and lighting, they did provide a document that indicated that the proposed systems will be painted white. 57 of those will contain the red strobe lights so that they can be seen at night by air traffic. And this meets the county's requirements, and our ordinance generally yields to the FAA requirements as well. The minimum ground clearance in accordance with the county's ordinance is 75 feet. They will exceed that requirement. Setbacks, there's provisions in the ordinance addressing residences, schools, hospitals, churches, or public libraries. There's a 1,000-foot separation distance that's required from the wind energy conversion system, and they will meet those requirements. There's also a requirement that the rotor not extend across a common property line. There's five that will. In those cases, the ordinance says that they are to provide written easement for those situations, and that information has been provided. They are requesting a variance, which the variances are addressed by the Board of Adjustment on 14 of the setback requirements. The ordinance requires a setback from the right-of-way of 1.1 times the proposed height of the unit. And again, there's 14 units that will not meet that. All of the units, however, will meet the, you know, the total height will be extended to the right-of-way limits. It would not go into the right-of-way. So the greatest variance that would be requested from the from an 87-meter rotor would be 3.5 feet short of a 445.5-foot setback requirement. And then for the 91-meter rotors, the maximum variance would be 20.2 feet of the required 453.2 foot setback. There's also a setback from electrical communication lines of 1.1 times the total height. There are four that would not meet the 1.1. That would meet the total height, but not the 1.1 requirement. It's a regional line owned by ITC, and they indicated that they would provide support from that company with regard to that. There's also a noise maximum limit for these systems of not to exceed 60 decibels as measured from a resident, school, hospital, church, or public library. And they did provide a document from Epsilon Associates indicating that this standard will be met. Safety, the county's regulation does require that from grade up 15 feet that it not be climbable. The support structures are smooth surface. They do have doors that are padlocked for security. The applicant will provide certification from an Iowa licensed engineer when the zoning permits are submitted that the proposed rotor and hub assemblies will meet the National Electric Code and that they will be structurally compatible with the existing supports. The applicants also provided information about spill prevention, talked about where oil is located on these systems, where oil is stored, the frequency of inspections, the facility security, loading and unloading, discharge prevention equipment, and ongoing review of the plan. There was some information submitted on cultural resources. They had a document submitted by Commonwealth Heritage Group who did an analysis on historic properties within the proximity of the project area. They did note a few locations. However, they said that because this is a conversion project and not a new construction project, they noted that impact would not be likely. They also provided a document from Environmental Consulting Technology on migratory bird patterns and determined that because much of this land is agricultural row crop and that there weren't large wetlands within this project area, that impact of migratory birds would not likely be an issue. They did, however, note some sites to the east, like Dakin's Lake, where birds would be more likely to stop during their flight patterns. There is information on decommissioning. Decommissioning cost estimates are required from a professional Iowa licensed engineer addressing financial resources that will be available to pay decommissioning and removal of the wind energy systems. They are to provide financial resource up to 130% of whatever it would cost to remove this information. And when this was initially approved, they did provide a decommissioning agreement and guarantee that was eventually signed by the Board of Supervisors, where they agreed to pay up to $4 million to cover the cost of removal should this not be in operation for a one-year period. And they've indicated that that the cost will not increase, and we have asked for documentation with that regard. We have a condition that addresses this. The county's ordinance also addresses shadow flicker. And there is a maximum exposure that's permitted of 30 hours per year. Actual exposure on a dwelling, school, hospital, church, or public library cannot exceed 10 hours. And it indicates that if there are any of those structures within 10 times the height of the proposed wind energy conversion system, they have to do an analysis, which they provided. And there are 21 properties initially that could be impacted. The ordinance basically requires that the ordinance be met or that they provide documentation from the landowner that they're in support of the thresholds that they will be providing. You have a document in front of you that addresses the outlines of the 21 properties. The green represents those that both sides have reached an agreement. The yellow, and my understanding is that there's actually been additional that have been approved, but the yellow represents those that are being reviewed either by the applicant's attorney or the property owner's attorney, and then the white represents those that they have not come to terms yet. And we have a condition with regard to this issue. Truck routing, for the most part, will be used. They're going to use I-35, Highway 30, and Highway 65 are the main roads. There are several access roads, drives, built into this project, which will be used. They do not plan to build any new roads with this project. There is a avoidance and mitigation of damages requirement or road maintenance agreement that is, it was reviewed by the county engineer, and it's currently being reviewed by the county attorney's office, but they've indicated that they will post a performance bond for $750,000 to cover repairs to county roads if it's needed. C2C plan, there's some information that's worth noting. In one of the chapters on economic prosperity, there's a couple of goals that we think relates to this project. Goal one talks about cooperate regionally to focus on common goals and allocate resources according to maximum successful business startup retention, expansion, and recruitment efforts. Two says create a healthy and a sustainable regional economy by retention, expansion, and recruitment of business. Four talks about create and encourage a regulatory environment that offers flexibility, consistency, predictability, clear direction, and enhances economic development opportunities. So there's five things that the Planning and Zoning Commission and the Board of Adjustment is to consider with a conditional use permit. The first one is a look at compatibility. I'll go through the staff comments. With regard to compatibility, existing wind energy conversion systems are located in the northeast part of the county. They've been there for 10 years. Predominant land use for the most part is agricultural row crop. Applicant has lease agreements with landowners addressing plans for maintenance of the systems. The conversion to the new rotors will be larger than the existing rotors, but it's not likely that it will be, you know, the difference, likely 20 feet on each side. It will be difficult to notice that from the right of way. We had to look at transition, whether or not buffering is needed. The location for these systems was chosen because of the wind that's generated in this part of the county. And these systems rely on separation and spacing to perform in an optimal level. Buffering, installing trees may affect their optimal performance. You are to look at traffic. The applicant is working with the county engineer to develop the road maintenance agreement. It's being reviewed by the county attorney's office. The applicant has communicated their conversion plans with the property owners and have lease agreements. Existing drives will be used to pick up and drop off the rotors and hub assemblies and related parts. Parking and loading, trucks will not be permitted to park on county roads for this project. Unloading and loading of the rotors and hub assemblies will occur at the wind energy conversion systems and or the lay down yard area. Signs and lighting, no signage or lighting of the wind energy site is proposed other than the lighting of a little over half of these systems. If lighting and signs were proposed, they would have to meet the county's requirements. Environmental protection, the applicant will meet the noise maximum of 60 decibels. Highway 65 will be the main north-south road that will be used. Dust control measures will be addressed as part of the road maintenance agreement. Lighting will be required to meet county and FAA requirements, again, for the top of the systems. The applicant will be required to remove all component parts from the conversion project from all properties, including the laydown, and we have a condition on that. We didn't take photos of all 100, Wind Energy Systems. This is actually the row of systems that are just north of the proposed Met Tower site. Just to give you an idea, this is one of the drives extending to those. And you know, there's a speed limit sign. There's also a county address sign that is installed at each of these drive accesses. That's looking to the north and then northeast from the Met Tower site, and then a little closer view. So if the Board of Adjustment concludes that all development criteria will be met by the applicant, it shall approve the application and plans unless it concludes, based on the information submitted, the official application materials, and at the hearing, that if completed as proposed, there is a strong probability, and then there's certain items that you are to review with regard to health, safety, general welfare, the impact on air and light, congestion to roads, valuation to properties. We did provide information or response to all these in the staff report, and I'd be happy to do that if you have questions. We did have conceptual review with regard to this project June 28th of last year. We received the application May 20. It was routed to all the interagency review staff members. We had several questions. We provided that information in the staff report. The applicants have done a great job of responding to those questions and providing the additional information that was requested. We did provide information to the cities of McCallsburg, Zeering, and Colo, and the utilities to give them a heads up about the project May 30. And today we have not heard from the cities or the utilities. We did send notices May 28th to property owners within the project boundary, and we received five either emails or phone calls. One was a general inquiry about the project, so we provided some background information. One was a focus on questions with regard to shadow flicker. Three was with regard to the laydown yard and discussions about that. One was a property owner who currently lives out of state and had questions about distance to the proposed project and their two properties. And then we had a property owner who is negotiating who had questions about the meeting tonight and the shadow flicker. And we went through what our conditions are. And again, we do have a condition that addresses shadow flicker. So some of the points that we think are relevant here, the general provisions of the land development regulations do focus on Code of Iowa Chapter 3355, and that's to encourage efficient urban development patterns, secure safety from fire, flood, panic, or other dangers, protect health and general welfare, facilitate adequate provision of transportation, water, wastewater treatment, schools, parks, and public requirements. The objective of the conditional use permit process, though, is to encourage compatibility of proposed development with the environment and with the existing and future land uses of the area. Again, this has been providing a service for 10 years. The through the CUP application submittal, Story County Wind expresses their commitment with landowners and the county to continue producing wind energy. It is planned. The proposed new wind components will increase operational efficiency, extend operational life cycle, and then create economic opportunity in the county. So planning and development staff is recommending approval of this conditional use permit at CUP 05-19. There is a variance that will be addressed by the Board of Adjustment, but these are the seven conditions. I'll go through them. The first condition is the applicant shall submit documentation from an Iowa licensed engineer when the zoning permit applications are submitted for the proposed 100 wind energy conversions, system conversions that will meet the National Electric Code, and that the existing structural supports will accommodate the weight of the proposed rotors and hub assemblies. Two, the applicant shall submit documentation of continued financial capability to cover the 130% of decommissioning costs as determined by an Iowa licensed engineer for the proposed 100 units prior to the Board of Adjustment acting on the CUP and the variance request, and ultimately acting on the enacted on by the Board of Supervisors, which is what the process was for the first time around. Three, all negotiations with property owners shall be completed, or the applicant shall provide documentation that the county's regulation will be met regarding shadow flicker prior to the Board of Adjustment acting on the CUP and variance request. So this gets to the waiver. Again, there to meet the county's requirements on that threshold or provide documentation from the landowner that they agree to the change. So this is something that the Planning and Zoning Commission recommends to the Board of Adjustment, that waiver. The applicant, though, may, however, request the Board of Adjustment to table action on a wind energy conversion system conversion request involving a negotiation with a property owner that is not finaled so as to not delay the project. Four, the applicant shall submit documentation from ITC, the owner of the electrical transmission line, that they support the requested setback from the proposed wind energy conversion system prior to Board of Adjustment acting on the CUP and variance request. Five, the applicant shall submit a road maintenance agreement and financial security equal to 130% of all required improvements as approved by the Story County Engineer prior to Board of Adjustment acting on the CUP and variance request. Six, any crates, packing material, damaged or worn parts, oil and lubricant containers, barrels, and other items associated with removal and installation of the proposed CUP, or excuse me, W, wind energy conversion system conversion shall be removed from the wind energy conversion sites and are laid down yard and discarded in a timely manner meeting county and state requirements not to exceed 30 days after project completion. And seven, all equipment and supplies associated with the removal and installation process of the wind energy conversions shall be removed from the laid down yard not to exceed 90 days after all 100 wind energy conversions have been completed, and the laydown yard ground shall be restored to the current condition to accommodate agricultural use. And with that, that leads us to the recommendation to alternative number two, which is the Story County Planning and Zoning Commission recommends approval of the CUP 0519 with conditions. And with that, I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. Does anyone on the commission have any specific questions for Jerry related to the presentation?
Are we supposed to be able to hear you?
I have a question.
How's that? Can you hear us?
I'm sorry. Is that better?
Yeah, you got the microphone close.
No?
Could. How about now?
It doesn't sound like the speakers are working. So.
I don't know that it's working.
So. Could the staff or the petitioner define shadow flicker for us, please?
Yeah, that's a good one.
From the ordinance? It's the shadow that's cast on one of those four structures during that time period, and it can't exceed the 10 hours per year.
On a residence library.
There we go.
And if the proposed rotor, the system, 10 times that is would extend to any of those structures, then they have to do this analysis, which they provided. And that's where they came up with the report that 21 of them would be affected.
Can you discuss what the impact of shadow flicker might be on a homeowner?
I would defer to the applicant on that.
I have some shadow flicker questions too, so do we just want to all those?
Right now it's questions for staff related to the presentation.
Yeah, so. I can generally state that it's, if you're, I've heard that if you're in your house, you can see that it's dark and it's light. It's dark, it's light. Every time the rotor goes around with the sun going through over a period of time. And that's what's experienced. And that's why there's a limit on the amount of that that's permitted. And so what they're requesting to do is exceed that threshold of the 10 hours per year.
That doesn't seem like a lot of time. These things are running all the time.
But do I understand it right? So I was approached by one of the people on this list, and their concern, if I understand it right, you're negotiating with them to pay them to give you a waiver because of the excess shadow flicker time. Is that correct?
Is that a question for staff?
Yeah, we'll get to it.
They'll have an opportunity in a minute to answer questions.
Our ordinance basically states that the applicant is to meet the requirement, or that it's they get a document signed by the owner that they support the increase, whatever it is.
Okay, well then this one to you then, Jerry. Can you go back one slide? Number three, if you can explain that to me, in layman's terms, that sounds to me like if everybody on this list is not in green, they will go forward.
And actually, the ones that are yellow have been reviewed. They're being reviewed, and there's less than that today than there were when we received that information. Mm-hmm. And so it's likely going to boil down to a few.
So what happens in that case? That's why I don't understand that statement of they can request the Board of Adjustment to table action so as not to delay the project.
Right. Yeah, we were asking that they not go forward until this is worked out with all the property owners. The last sentence, though, gives them the option to request to have that issue be addressed at a later meeting. If there's one that they haven't worked out an agreement with, that they come back after they've worked that out with that one so as to not hold it.
That's a meeting between the Planning Commission for a recommendation and then the Board of Adjustments?
This is for the Board of Adjustment.
So decision made by the Board of Adjustment.
So it goes directly to Board of Adjustments?
Yeah, this goes to the Board of Adjustment for action because it's a conditional use permit.
No, what I'm saying is for the waiver.
I'm not sure where your question is, Jonathan.
There's a waiver, right?
Yeah, if they don't meet the requirement.
The waiver is the... So there's two parts, right? There's an agreement between the individuals and the applicant. And if they reach an agreement that
then,
they're willing
then
to,
it's good to, go.
To waive the excess flicker.
But if there's a few homeowners that have not reached an agreement, then the project can still go forward based on...
They've requested to ask for an extension for those that they're still working on negotiating with those landowners so that the ones that have reached agreements, they can continue to work the project.
The assumption being that they could go forward but not addressing those particular towers,
correct.
Right? It's not explicit, I think, is the piece that's missing.
Right. I would agree with that because that makes sense to me that if it's explicit, then the people that don't agree, this isn't getting rammed down their throats. The tower, that tower is not going to be changed until an agreement's made with them. Right. Right?
Yeah. The intent was the ones that were completed.
Yep. I understand.
They'd be allowed to continue. Those that aren't, that they're asking to...
They're asking to not build that tower until they make the agreement with that part.
Right.
Okay. Right. Not upgrade the tower. Right. Towers already exist.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. They have to meet the ordinance, or they work out an agreement with the landowner, and then we get something in writing that states that they support the extension beyond.
Or they don't update. Or they never update. If they don't get an agreement ever, they never do that. They never upgrade. Correct.
Well, I'm sorry, what's the question? I don't know if I follow.
If they never get the agreement with this person.
Then they have to meet the requirements of the ordinance. They can still do the project, but they have to meet the requirements. Which
so
is
they
not
could
to
not
exceed.
Build the towers that affect that individual's home.
The ordinance allows for 10 hours.
There's 10.
Per year.
There's 100 towers already existing. They're upgrading the generator and the blades. The blades are expanding from a 77 meter diameter to either an 87 or a 91 meter diameter. Which,
well, I understand.
Which
I misfighting mean to say like there isn't a tower there. They just can't do the retrofit on the tower that that impacts the non-agreeing owners, homeowners.
My understanding is there's a way that they can work with their system to meet the requirements, even with the new rotors.
Is
Is this shadow flicker list, was the original, did exceeding the 10 hours too on these?
With the very first submittal?
Pardon me? The original ones that are there, for these that are all, they're all exceeding the 10 hour. Were they already exceeding the 10 hours?
I believe this is like an amendment that took place after they were constructed.
So the shadow flicker is a new requirement?
It's almost treated like somewhat of a new project. They have to meet this current requirement.
And would that probably be because there was some disagreement about the amount of flicker as it being a new problem that wasn't thought out?
I think the issue, it's a national issue. And so it got attention, I think, after these were constructed.
So 10 hours is, how recent is that, would you estimate that restriction?
I think it's been within the last 5 to 6 years. Okay. It was before I got here.
Okay.
So because they're removing the rotors and the hub assembly material, they're having to meet this requirement.
All right, any other questions for staff about their presentation? No? Okay, so now is the time for public comment. We'd start with the applicant. So if you're going to comment, please go to the podium where there's a microphone that should be working, and state your name and address for the record. Yep.
Good evening. My name is Jeffrey Rice. I'm the project manager for Nextera Energy Resources as well as Story County Wind LLC. I'd like to start off by thanking the board for their time tonight to come out and hear us. Firstly, I do have a very small presentation with some just a few slides we could walk through to give you a little more background and expand on the staff report. And then I was taking some notes during a discussion there. I'd like to conclude with answering it or expanding on some of those questions. I don't think I have a way to control that.
Yeah, I can help you.
Yeah, so you can just click through until this all fills in. But I like to start off by reminding everybody of Nextera Energy's values. You know, we're committed to excellence. We have the very best folks working for us. And we really shine on that. I've invited most of my team out tonight. I think I brought about 10 folks. And the idea there is to make sure that any question that the board has tonight is able to be answered by that expert, by that person that deals directly with that issue or question every day. They're the ones to get you the correct answer. Next is we do the right thing, and really the committed excellence plays into that. We wouldn't be a member of this community if you wouldn't have us. Our landowner support is our cornerstone. We're unable to build these projects without our landowner support. So making sure we treat our landowners with respect and do the right thing is really our two biggest points. We've been a member of this community for 10 years now. We have two operating sites in this community, and we're looking to remain a member of that community. Secondly, we are American-owned and operated. We have wind projects in 32 states, including 4 provinces in Canada. In 2018, we were the largest producer of wind and solar energy in the world. That it was true for 2017, we're hoping to continue that for 2019 as well. To give you just a real quick project timeline, we started the due diligence on this site back in 2018. We came in, we met with Jerry and staff early in 2018, kind of hammered out a few issues. We had a few changes, which I'll talk about in a moment. Moving forward, we have a landowner dinner. We were hoping to have that dinner prior to tonight's meeting. Unfortunately, we had to move it back 1 week for some scheduling issues with the venue. So we will be able to host that dinner for our signed landowners. During that time, we invite everybody that's pretty much in the room today from my team, our construction crews, our contractors, to make sure that specific questions and concerns about individual properties can be met. It's really a good place to bring everybody up to the same speed, as well as make hand-to-hand introductions and pass contact info along, so that during our construction phase, that landowners know exactly who they need to reach out to with any questions or concerns. We have real quick the project overview, which Jerry alluded to earlier. I believe you actually have a copy in front of you as well. Kind of shows the project as a whole. Right there in the middle, it does identify our lay down yard, which we spoke of as well. It's a centralized point in the project area. The purpose of that lay down yard is to house mostly our construction trailers and offices. Wheel and trucks that will come in, just so it's a central place to house small equipment and small components, but mostly people. So the proposed maintenance for this site, Story Wind is a 150 megawatt site with 101.5 GE wind turbine machines. You see there that we've got the 77 meter blades with an 80 meter rotor diameter. The project size of the 150 megawatts is going to remain unchanged. You see below that we are proposing 101.62 megawatt machines. Theoretically, the 1.5 and the 1.62 are the same machine. It's a software input. In the 10 years since the site was originally developed, as you can see with cell phones and all other technologies, we've had some software increases that allow us to kind of capture that 0.12 incremental increase in energy through not only software, but some generator improvements, as well as gearboxing and the blades. So we are proposing two different types of blades here in Story County. The first one being the 91-meter rotor blades and the 87. All in all, you can see that it's about a 23-foot delta between what it is today and the biggest blade that we would see with the board's approval. So diving just a little deeper on why we see the two different types of blades. Early last year, mid last year, when we came in and spoke to the planning staff and understanding some of the requirements that we'd like to meet, it was noted that we'd like to conform as much as possible to current Story County ordinances. A question was mentioned earlier about if shadow flicker was a requirement when the site was originally constructed. It was not. It was just something that was not conceptualized back when the site was originally built. So today, yes, there are, of the 20 violations, 19 of those receptors are currently over the Story County limit today with the 77-meter blades. So moving to the 87-meter blades and the 91-meter blades, we strategically placed those 87-meter blades. There are 34 receptors that are directly impacted by shadow flicker, by wind turbines in the project. So we strategically placed those 87-meter blades near receptors to limit the amount of shadow flicker that those receptors would see. This is also for noise as well. Even though the proposed project does meet Story County noise ordinance, we still were doing everything we can to bring those levels as low as possible. We then took the, the big thing here is the proposed maintenance will utilize the current towers. This is no new construction. We're not looking to add additional wind turbines, and we're not looking to remove them. All landowners that have turbines today will continue to have turbines. And just real quickly speaking towards some of the benefits, it is income. This is one of the highest paying yield crops there are is wind energy. It remains compatible with ranching and farming. You know, we wouldn't be able to keep building these projects throughout the nation if they hindered the ability for folks to use their land the way they see fit. Secondly, road improvements. As Jerry alluded to, we are working with the roads department to ensure that a new road use agreement is put in place. We will strictly identify which roads we intend to use. Once that agreement is executed, we'll then take our construction team, as well as the roads department, will go out and identify all roads, determine any maintenance or any upkeep that needs to be maintained in order to allow this traffic to come through. All of those costs are solely on NextEra during this construction phase, as well as the reclamation phase. This will be no cost to taxpayers to allow us to use your county roads. In addition to that, we're going to post a bond so that post-construction period for a determined amount of time, the county has the ability to either work with us to repair roads or draw on a separate bond to fix those roads themselves. So there'll be two avenues that the county can choose to use. And lastly, energy is clean, homegrown, affordable energy. You know, this is American-generated energy that's produced and used right here in Iowa. And then moving forward, $11.4 million in property taxes over the life of the project. We're going to continue our 4-6 our local O&M operation maintenance folks, the guys that actually maintain the sites every day. We've invited Nick out here, who is our supervisor of the O&M building. He's available for any questions he may have during operations. Lastly, the sites can remain efficient, reliable, and safe, just as the county has seen these projects operating for the last 10 years. And again, we like to harp on that, you know, this is American energy independence. So with that, we do have just a couple site pictures to kind of give an idea of what this maintenance process will look like. We see here on your left, the lay down yard being cut in. We're going to strip off all that topsoil, make sure that's placed off to the side as it's not contaminated or compacted. We'll then come in and we see copper, as well as some other components being staged. This is very similar to what you'll see, as well as when the site was originally developed. However, we won't need to store all those large blades or hub components or tower sections or anything like that. So be a lot less components on site. Our erection crane all right, this is pretty much going to be construction in reverse. And there you can jump one more forward. We will lower the, actually, let me back up just a minute. For this maintenance period, you can jump forward, sorry, Gary. The nacelle will not need to be lowered for this maintenance activity. All components that need to be done will remain up tower. So the only thing that will actually be lowered to the ground are the blade assembly, because we're going to be replacing those out, swapping them out. The actual nacelle, the big box, which houses the gearbox and the actual generator, will remain up tower. So once we lower the blades, the work will be done within the nacelle, and then the new rotors will be lifted and flown into place. Like I said, very similar to when the site was originally built. We're looking to, in restoration, the site will continue to operate drastically unchanged from what it is today. But we're talking a little bit about how long we'll see each crane on site, stuff like that timeline. We spoke a little bit about mobilization in July, looking at beginning deliveries to the end of July, with construction beginning about August, and then moving through November. So the name of the game is going to be speed, right? Staying out of everybody's way. We understand that folks are going to be pulling their crops out during the vast majority of that time. So we're going to maintain our access roads as much as possible, keep on those. And then I also brought my construction guys to speak a little bit more timing, but it's going to be about 1 to 2 days per tower for the big crane. To get the big crane in there and do what they need to do. And keep that train moving. They're the biggest impact to landowners, so just keep that train moving. So we're hoping for about 1 to 2 days per tower with the big crane. That is weather contingent. Hopefully we do have a nice mild winter here and we don't see anything over the last few years. With that, this is a little bit of a slide about our environmental. And I'd like to invite Natalie Flynn up, who is our environmental support site.
Thank you,
Jeff,
for the introduction, and thanks, y'all, for having me here today. So I'm Natalie Flynn. I'm with NextEra's environmental team. I support Jeff on this project. So we're really committed as a company to developing and operating wind farms in an environmentally responsible manner. It's something that we take very seriously. When the project was originally sited, it was determined to have a low risk. They looked at things like wildlife habitat, wetlands, overall, compared to other sites across the country, a low risk project. Where during the repower effort, we're using the existing infrastructure, so not building any new roads, not expanding any areas, so we're sticking to what's already been served. When the project went operational, we implemented a wildlife reporting system. So what that is an injured bird or bat is found at the site. We report that internally and report it to agencies as needed. We've not had any raptors or any state or federally listed species at the project to date. And the repower activities will continue to follow environmental best practices. We hired a team of Midwest-based environmental consultants for the project to look at Pleasant Bay wetlands, wildlife habitat, and coastal resources back in 2018. We don't believe that there are any signs of endangered species likely to occur within the project area, and we also don't anticipate any physical species.
So this is actually just a duplicate slide. Sorry about that. We kind of changed it just a little bit. You can jump one more forward. And then lastly, I'd like to invite Ryan Callahan. Ryan conducted all of our noise and shadow flicker analysis. Ryan's a third-party consultant. And I'd like to have him just quickly walk through how his studies were conducted. And then towards the end of that, I'd like to open all of ourselves up to questions.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for...
Name and address, please, for the record.
Oh, sorry.
Yep.
My name is Ryan Callahan. My address is 465 Great Road, in Stowe, Massachusetts. So a little distance from home today. As Jeff said, he asked me to conduct the sound and flicker studies for this project, and I'd just like to tell you a little bit about myself first, if we kick to the first slide. So I work for a company called Epsilon Associates. Epsilon is an environmental consulting firm that specializes in noise studies, air studies, historical, wetland, and other environmental impact studies. My role at Epsilon for the past 13 years has been in the community noise study arena, also performing shadow flicker studies for wind projects. I've worked on over 70 wind projects in 19 different states over that time, which has taken me many places I wouldn't normally have been, which has been nice. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the sound and flicker studies that I did for the Story 1 Green Power project. And if we go to the next slide, I'll start with the sound modeling portion. The Story County sound limit is 60 decibels, and that applies at a home, school, or hospital. So we performed sound modeling using a sophisticated 3D model to predict the sound levels, the maximum sound levels that would be produced by the Repower project. And we discovered that the highest level we would see after the Repower would be 50 decibels, which is well below the county limit of 60. I'd just like to talk briefly a little bit about how that model arrives at that sound level. So as I mentioned, it's a 3D model, so we pull in terrain from the National Elevation Data Set. So it does account for the rolling hills and the differences in elevations that we'll have here. It also takes into account all the project information, including the coordinates of the turbines, the coordinates of each of these homes in the project area. And then the model applies the maximum sound level of each turbine. We don't stop there. We then add an uncertainty factor to that sound level because the manufacturer will provide us with sound data that tells us how loud each turbine is capable of going, and we add an uncertainty factor to that for some conservatism. And then when we actually click calculate and let the model do its thing, the model follows a protocol, a set of mathematical equations. That's called the ISO 9613 methodology, and that methodology is inherently conservative because it does things like assume downwind conditions at all times in all directions. So if you have a turbine on the east and a turbine on the west, and you are in between them, the model is actually assuming that wind is coming from both east and west simultaneously, which of course can't be the case unless something really interesting is going on with the weather that day. So that's the end of the sound level discussion there. If we go to the next slide, I'd like to talk a bit about the shadow flicker model study. Once again, the model is a 3D model that we use here. And with that, the Story County limit, let me back up one step, excuse me. The Story County limit is a bit unique with respect to shadow flicker in that it presents both a limit for the worst case flicker and also the expected flicker. In my experience, the limits in Story County are more restrictive than the majority of other wind energy facilities that have limits. So we looked at those limits and we applied them to the Repower project. And in doing so, we discovered that there were 20 locations. I know we spoke about 21, but the correct number is 20 locations that would be over one or both of these limits. The worst case limit is 30 hours per year.
Are we actual? I'm sorry. Are we on the right slide? I don't think we are.
Yeah, I think we're one behind.
Yeah.
I was asked to move back.
That's fine. Yep. Sorry, this is actually the previous version. So the limits of Story County are 30 hours per year of maximum shadow flicker, or 10 hours per year of actual or expected shadow flicker. So in doing the shadow flicker model, we discovered that there were 20 locations that would be over either one or both of those limits. Just for reference, as Jeff mentioned, we did run the model assuming the existing present day condition with a 77 meter rotors. And in doing that, we discovered that 19 of those 20 were already above one or both of those limits under existing present-day conditions. So if we go to the final slide, I just want to talk a bit about how, again, how we arrive at those numbers. So we use a modeling software program called WinPro. WinPro is, again, a 3D software model that, again, incorporates the terrain of the site and the geometry of where the turbines are in X, Y, and Z space, and then the geometries of where each home or receptor is in X, Y, and Z space. And then it assumes that each home is a greenhouse. So what that means is the model is blind to where the windows in the actual home are. It assumes it's a round house with windows everywhere. So that means if there's a home that has no windows, that's an extremely conservative assumption, or if there's not windows on a particular side, it's a conservative assumption. And then the model takes that information and calculates what's called worst case. And that assumes that the sun is always shining, so there's never any cloudy days, which in my experience here today, absolutely the case at all times. But there's never any cloudy days. The turbines are always operating. They're never down for maintenance. They're never down because there's no wind. They're always spinning. And they're also operating in a fashion where they are perpendicular to each of the receptors. And what I mean by that is, as they yaw through the wind, if the wind is blowing at your residence or away from your residence directly, the turbines will be at the worst orientation for flicker. If the wind is crosswind to you and the blades are pointing at you, there's less of a footprint for the flicker to occur. The worst case assumes that all of these are happening all year long, 365 days. And then from that, an actual or expected duration is calculated by feeding the model more information, such as sunshine probability of the area, and also the operational statistics based on wind direction and wind speeds from an on-site met tower. And that is the end of my discussion, but I'm here to answer any questions about the sound or flicker studies as needed.
Thank you. So just in conclusion, before we open ourselves up to questions, so to really follow up on a few points that are made by the board as well as some of my folks talked about, it mainly shadow flicker here. Ryan spoke about how conservative the model is and what you guys are seeing. Story County is on the more strict side, as we would say, or more stringent on their limits, and we understand that. So the reason that we are out here today negotiating with landowners, trying to obtain waivers and all that, is to be fully compliant with Story County's zoning ordinance. In an effort to do that, we spoke a little bit about the 87-meter rotors. Those were, as we said, strategically placed as an effort to lower not only noise, but shadow flicker as well near receptors. Another question was asked about if the project could proceed without the variance in place from a landowner, or the waiver in place from a landowner. What we've asked and what we've been working with Jerry is that no turbine shall be constructed with the new rotor if a waiver is not in place, or that we prove through Jerry, through Ryan's modeling and our on-site, that we can meet the Story County zoning ordinance requirements. We've attested that. I'd like to go on the record as saying that again, that we will not construct anything with new rotor diameters on any tower that is not fully compliant with Story County. And lastly, in conclusion, myself and my team, we respectfully request that the Planning and Zoning Board tonight approves the recommendation by the county staff report, and we look forward to continuing to work well with this community. And with that, any questions that the board has and staff has for my team would be greatly appreciated.
All right, thank you. Does the commission have any questions for the applicant?
I just have two.
Yes, sir.
So do you expect in another 10 years that you're going to – is 10 years the expected lifespan, or was this a technological curve that you hit?
Sure. So in no way is this the expected life expectancy of the site. What we saw here was a little unique. We had an opportunity where our current off-taker, and to give just a little bit of back history of the site, we sold the power to four different co-ops. Three of them were listed on the board today, as well as some others, that all had a stake in the project, right? They were using the power. Those power purchase agreements, as they're called, were tended to roll off, meaning their contracts were expiring. So we went to our main off-taker and said, hey, we'd like to continue this site going, and we'd like to sign another long-term contract with you. With anything, prices are dropping. So in order to maintain the site and keep it relevant with the CPAs rolling off, the idea was proposed by our team and to our customer to retrofit the site to bring it up back up to today's technology standards and allowing us to lower the price for the customer so that they could purchase the power at a cheaper price, so to speak. That was the main driver. But in doing so, we realized a few years ago that around 10 years, we were starting to see some maintenance cycles that were lining up with each other. So this is a great way for us to come in one time and identify issues on every tower where we only have to bring the crane in once. Nick can attest to this, that it's no fun if we have a main bearing fail and we got to bring out the crane, and then 2 weeks later, two turbines over, we have a similar issue, and it wouldn't make sense to do both those maintenances at the same time. So with this project, we'll be able to do a lot of those same maintenance exercises as well.
So, and my next question is, was the impetus to do this, it was more what you're seeing on your maintenance records? Did it have anything to do with the one that caught on fire and self-destructed?
It did not. This okay. was planned prior to that, unfortunate event.
And that was a lightning hit that took out one blade, and then it continued to burn down to the hub and the nacelle. Am I correct on it?
You are correct. Yeah.
Okay.
So, but, you know, it also, the lightning strike was very unfortunate, but at the same time, it kind of lends a little into the safety record of the site. It was unfortunate, but it is the only occurrence we've had.
So, and you said you've got two sites in Story County. What's the total megawatts between those two sites?
I don't recall the Story 2 site off the top of my hand. I can have Kimberly look it up for me, and I can grab that.
It's okay. It's not that big of a deal.
I apologize.
Thank you. Are they approximately equal?
So 300 in total, sorry. So 150 okay. and 150.
Okay.
Although the Story 2 site does extend out of Story.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Just about the wildlife. The things listed were specific ones that you're required to look for, the falcons and birds, or were you doing everything?
So we take a comprehensive look, but of course our focus is on those species that are threatened or endangered, and that's determined at the state and federal level.
And do you do anything in construction that minimizes that?
Mm-hmm. So things that would attract any of those species to the site? Oh, I'll go this way. Can't talk that loud. So during construction, we have wildlife-specific BMPs, best management practices, and our construction folks, I'm sure, can speak to that as well. So things that we avoid, things that would attract any of those species to the site, so making sure that all the trash is contained and not spilling around, attracting any raptors or their prey. Also, same goes for any roadkills on the site. We remove that so that it doesn't attract them to the site. But as our memo from our wildlife consultants suggested, we don't really believe that from the habitat perspective that there's anything to attract them specifically to this effect.
And changes in technology, is that improving? like how the blades are, the construction of them or the makeup of the blades or anything?
Yeah.
How do you minimize the attraction, and do you study the migratory patterns?
So we'll note in the pre-construction studies any potential for the wildlife habitats, but not specifically during migration. What we record is like if we find an injured or a fatality at the site, that's what we would record, regardless of its designation.
Versus
less. Oh, yeah, and another, so as certain technology has changed, the blades haven't really changed, but the tower itself, so previous wind farms used a lattice structure, so like kind of what you see at cell towers, and that would provide roosting habitat for raptors, whereas we have these tubular towers that the birds can't sit on.
Another question on something else? Just curiosity, you have, it sounds like, met the requirements on lighting, but how much of an issue is that with landowners, have you found?
So lighting, FAA lighting is unfortunately, it is a signal point for some folks. We at NextEra, and this is true for any wind developer out there, we are held to Federal Aviation Administration requirements. We get no input, unfortunately, into siting requirements or lighting requirements. We believe that in the future that may change with FAA's restrictions limiting and improvements in aircraft radar and such. But at this time, when we proposed this maintenance to the FAA, we showed them our current lighting plan as well as our current tip height, the overall height of the system. We then showed them our proposed locations, which remain unchanged, as well as the increase in the tip height. They then came back to us and said, everything looks good. It's completely compatible with the surrounding airspace. However, to bring the site up to current lighting standards, we would like you to meet this new lighting requirement. That did involve changing out the type of light that is on some of the turbines, as well as shifting some of the lights around to, like I said, bring it up to the standards. And as I said, unfortunately, we have to be 100% compliant with them. We don't have any input back. It's kind of a thumbs up or thumbs down scenario from the FAA.
Does it impact the light pollution? I know it's the flickering light draws your eye to it, but does it impact visibility of night stars or anything?
No more so than it would be true today.
How many, so you're talking about 100 towers that you need to do this to, taking the rotor assemblies off, not taking the generator capsule down. How many simultaneously are you looking at doing, or are these all, are you going to be doing these two cranes, three cranes in parallel, or just one crane in serial?
Four turbines at a time.
So we're looking at three crane trains, as we like to call them. So there will be three crews, in theory, working each side of the site. I don't believe it'll be hammered out. It will start the north, the south, the east, the west. It'll probably come down to current conditions when we get on site, seeing what makes the most sense. But it'll be multiple towers will be worked on at the same time. And that's in an effort to expedite the process.
Right. So you'd mentioned, let's say 2 days per tower and three crews simultaneously. What's your proposed start and end date?
Start date, we're looking for probably the first or second week of August. End date, we'd like to be done before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
That answers. I've done some math over here. I'm like, they ain't get this done.
So,
but thank you.
I'll defer any
And if I can expand,
harvesting questions to
sure.
Kathy.
Yeah. And just expanding on that a little bit more, as our second slide said there, we treat people with respect, we do the right thing, we commit excellence. We're here to be a member of this community. We've been a member of this community for 10 years. We're not looking to make any enemies. We want to remain friendly with everybody. So that will include making sure that we are meeting requirements for every landowner, that we're on their property doing such and such. So if that means that it would make more sense if we could get a little off the road. They tend to use our access road for a grain bin or something like that, and they'd like to see us kind of work our way around a certain corner. We're completely allowed to, we're completely compliant in doing so. We'd like to work with all of our landowners as much as possible. That'll also come true if we're taking deliveries. We want to make sure that if somebody is going to be hauling a lot out that day, that we're not interfering with their access on a certain road or anything along those lines to make sure that they can still meet their daily needs.
Was the flicker an issue with the initial installation, or is this one of those things you put them up and went, the people that lived around them went, we don't like this now?
So,
did you have that because of your other installations that on the record?
So, Shadow Flicker was not a Story County requirement when the site was originally built.
Okay.
Today, it is a standard in most ordinances. Story County is a little bit more on the stringent side with that, being at the lower end. Usually we see 30 hours being the maximum that each target that you're trying to hit. Story County is down near 10, right at 10 is what Story County is. That being said, we knew we were coming in and we were proposing this maintenance exercise. We knew it was something that the industry pays attention to now, and we knew that we needed to pay attention to it as well.
What are the negative impacts of shadow flicker?
So I would have to probably jump over to Ryan and Natalie here a little bit more on the health effect side, but would you have any documentation or be able to allude on that a little bit?
Sure. So there are no health effects from shadow flicker. There's been numerous studies that have been done for both sound and flicker. It's really, what it goes down to is it's an annoyance. So if it's happening, it's an indoor phenomenon. So if you're in your home and the flicker is happening, if you normally would have just sun shining through your window, you're having it blocked intermittently as the blades are passing by.
So no problems with epilepsy or headaches?
No, so epilepsy is triggered by a flashing of five or more hertz, we call it, so very fast strobing that would happen five to, I think it's 60 times per second, so every second you need very fast light, and the wind turbines at their maximum rotation, I think it's 16.2 RPMs is the maximum rotation, so we do a calculation, I think it's presented in our report, so we take the maximum RPMs and then multiply by 3 because there's 3 blades, divide by 60 because there's 60 seconds in a minute, and show that the fastest that it could possibly strobe is less than 1 hertz. I think it's about 0.6 hertz, so less than 1 flash per second, which is below the threshold of epileptic.
So the ordinance is written for an annoyance factor?
That's been my experience, yeah. Whenever there's these ordinances, it's to protect against some level of annoyance caused by sound or flicker.
Why is it annoying?
Well, if you're trying to...
That probably depends on the person, too, right?
Yeah, that's
not be annoying for one, but real annoying for another.
Question.
Well, you know it's annoying, but why?
It's just a rapid change of light can be annoying to some people. It's not annoying to everyone.
Exactly. Could you compare the noise to something I could recognize? Like, what else is about at that noise level that I could picture?
Sure. So 60 decibels is a good reference where two people are having a normal volume conversation with each other. That is typically in the 60 to 65 decibel range. Sometimes if I'm talking to my grandparent, that may go up a bit. It's happening to me as well. But 60 to 65 is typical conversation. So 50 is the maximum predicted sound level that would be occurring here. That's a difference of about 10 decibels. And a 10 decibel reduction is a halving or doubling of sound. So if you're going from 60 to 50, you've essentially reduced that sound by half. So imagine a conversation and then cut it in half, and that's what 50 decibels would sound like. We could show that idea. There's a slide here that we can't put it on there right now, I guess, but
we could provide a copy of this, some follow-up submissions as well. I'll show it.
So this is the Planning and Zoning Commission. We're a recommending body. The Board of Adjustment is where the decision will be made.
Yes,
so maybe include that slide with for that.
And just to add on to that, the computer here is running a fan that's probably sitting around 45 to 50 decibels as well, just this computer.
Okay. Thank you.
And that would be the maximum, your calculated maximum.
Okay. To relate it to, and I can let Ryan jump on this, related to the site as it is today versus what it will be tomorrow, we saw about a 1 to 2 decibel increase. And I'll let you.
Yep, so as the blades get a little longer, they're cutting through a little bit more air, and they do make a small amount of additional sound, but that amount of sound compared to existing is about 1 decibel. And a 1 decibel change is not a perceptible change to our ears. We can measure it using very sophisticated microphones, but in order to perceive something getting louder, we need to change that sound level by at least 3 decibels. So an analogy I like to use is if you're watching television and you're hearing the television and you want it to be louder and you take the clicker and you click it once, you see the volume bar come up. Doesn't sound like it got any louder. So you keep clicking it until now I hear it. The point that now you hear it's noticeably louder, you change that sound level by at least 3. If you click it once, it doesn't sound any louder to you. but we could measure that using a very sensitive microphone.
And again, they are meeting the county's requirements not to exceed the maximum of 60 decibels
right.
with what they're proposing.
Are there any other questions for the applicant?
No.
All right.
Thank
you for your presentation. Now would then be the time for public comment and discussion. So any members of the public that would like to comment, please approach the podium and give us your name and address for the record. So now the time is yours.
My name is Cal Pearson. I live at 14772 670th Avenue, McCallsburg, Iowa. Now, I'm unusual because I'm not a landowner that has a turbine or a turbine. I am an acreage owner. I have great neighbors. I'm happy. I support wind energy. My concern is that when I bought my property in 2007, shortly after retiring, I didn't know anything that about a wind turbine coming within a quarter mile of my property. And then, you know, my concern is I think it could affect my property value. I think people are scared of the concept of wind turbine if they don't understand it. I am not unhappy with what we have right now. I can, once in a while, I can hear the wind turbine, you know, it's almost soothing, you know. Once in a while, I'll hear it. But it's not an annoying thing. I am concerned that a larger turbine, even though it's one decibel, that, you know, it might make more noise than it does now. And so my concern is, as a property owner in Story County, paying my taxes and doing everything I can, I have no benefit at all from wind turbines. Farmers get what they should, they get paid. I live with a change in my outlook. I get to see a turbine, I get to hear a turbine, and I'm concerned that that my property values might be affected. I'm in favor of wind energy, so don't get me wrong. But one question I would have to the board is, and maybe to the applicant, is it possible that the wind turbines that are within a quarter mile of a property, is it possible we could just leave those alone? There are a lot of other turbines that they can increase the size of the blades and do everything they need to, but I'm wondering why we just can't leave the ones closest to properties alone.
Good question.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you. What we'll do is we'll go through the public comments, and where there are questions, we'll have the applicant address those at the end, so we're not constantly going back and forth, if that's okay. Any other comments?
My name is Arden Greiner, 704-17180. Just curious where the blade's being made at, where are they manufactured?
All right. Thank you. We'll have them address that again at the end.
Lawrence and Barbara Howard, 73527 160th Street, St. Anthony. We live in Lincoln Township, Section 36. Currently, we have the residence and located there, and also we have farmland with two turbines on 26 and 27, I believe, are the numbers. The question is, I didn't hear the applicant discuss anything about the process of crop destruction, planning of different turbines around the removal of soybeans, which is usually first, and Cornfield second, and whether they've actually gone to any in-depth study on the sequence with that information in mind. And then we also have a property in section 36 that is off 150th Street affected by a flicker. And just a general comment to the board that we don't see it as a problem and intend to fully cooperate with the applicant on the situation. So we're in favor of the proposed upgrade.
Before you step away, so your question really about the crop destruction, is that about how to coordinate around harvest time, or
to minimize the crop any damages, etc., when they're lowering blades down to the ground, laying them horizontally, and you know all the traffic, because if you've watched setting up these cranes before, you know, it takes maybe 20 trucks full of weights and different things to assemble these big cranes on site, so they could get off the road and into the fields a bit, but for sure the blades will be laid down in the crop area.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you. Also, thank you for your flicker feedback. Anyone else?
My name is Ron Hewen. I own the land that was the source of the first lay down area and also be the source of the second lay down area. I've been involved with this company since they set up a research tower on my farmland. They told me it was, the area was designated by satellites that it would be this spot in my soybean field. And it amazed me, they put a tower up, 150-foot tower, they did not knock down a single soybean in the field. To that man's question about damages, at the end of building the original towers, I was told, and I have 7 towers on my property, that they had calculated the area around the towers beyond what they pay rent for that would be disturbed, crops damaged. They said, give us the yield for the rest of your field per acre, and then they would calculate how many square feet, parts of acres, they damaged. And then they said, and then triple it. I said, I think I can work with that. But I've been supportive of them before. I'm supportive of this lay down area. We bickered a little bit, but we got to a solution. And 10 years between, I figure another 10 years, I may not be around to do it again this time. I just have one small anecdote. When they very first started to build, they brought a 27-foot travel trailer onto their site with a gas generator and a satellite disc on top. I stopped by to talk to them. They had questions, where do you get your water, where do you get your electricity, and all of that, and give them my phone numbers and the information as I knew it. And I had a machine shed about half mile away from where their little trailer was. They called me up several days later, and they said, and it was in November, it was cold. They said they were trying to get some plywood and cut the size to put around the bottom of their trailer so it would make it a little warmer. But they said the wind was so fierce that they couldn't hold the big sheets of plywood. They said, can we use your machine shed to cut the pieces of plywood? And they said, you know, it's done nothing, the wind has done nothing but blow and blow since we came here.
Welcome to Iowa.
That's why you're here. But just another small thing, the subcontractors that the company used in the original were extremely helpful. If I had a question, if I had a requirement, can you move the road this way or this way so that we don't have point rows on my operator's planter and that kind of thing. They were very good at it. And initially I thought it was NextEra or Florida Power and Light. And I realized, you know, if they were this good at picking their subcontractors, I think I want to buy stock. And since I bought the stock, it is close to being quadrupled. So,
congratulations.
It's a good company, and I support it very much.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Alan Knappus at 14390 670th Avenue and in Culver. And my question is a little bit on the light flicker. Since it's an ordinance where you have to have, what are you approaching the landowners that have the light flicker? Or are the landowners approaching you complaining? Is there payment for the light flicker, or why is the difference? Because I have a light flicker, and it doesn't bother me too much, but mine's directly east, so it only occurs when the sun is directly east of me. So I just was curious if how you determine the light flicker.
Can I get your name again? I'm sorry.
Alan Canapus.
Alan, gotcha. Thank you. Is there anyone else? Any other comment? All right. If you want to go ahead,
sure,
I captured four questions, and maybe
I
was
well.
Not complete.
Would you like to just kind of go in order?
Please do.
The first question was based on property value and there being no benefit to unsigned landowners. Firstly, there's been numerous studies relating around property values. We've seen no decrease in property values adjacent to or within wind farms. Typically what we see is an increase in property value, given that field production does not decrease with wind turbines being near or around them. And in most parts, parcels with contracts on them now generate income for up to 90 years, regardless of the yield of the crop that may be planted on that field. That's typically what we see. Numerous property value assessments have been conducted by third parties. And moving forward for the board meeting, we could provide some of those documents as well. Secondly, being no benefit to landowners that are not signed. As the board knows, and the county as well, Story County 1 and Story County 2 pay property taxes every year in the hundreds of thousands of dollars annually. Those dollars go to roads, schools, public buildings, community centers, maintaining this county and helping to secure its future. So I would say that those are the benefits you see as a non-participating landowner. And that extends to all of Story County, from the folks that live in the northwest to the southeast that are pretty much as far away from the wind farm as you can get, you still see the same benefits in tax dollars. Secondly, where are the blades from? And Chris, I'd like to ask you on that one. Where are we shipping the blades from?
Most of the blades will come from North Dakota, Arkansas, or Texas.
So that would answer that question. And those are the manufacturing facilities, North Dakota, Arkansas, and Texas, where the blades will be coming from. Thirdly, we had a question on what we like to call crop comp. Per your current agreement, sir, all crop comp, as Mr. Hewitt alluded to, is done by NextEra. We are going to try and minimize the impact to everybody's field to the full extent possible. We don't want to be out there just destroying crops and all that. However, we will take some aerial site photos pre and post construction so we know exactly what was damaged. We then compare that back to the landowner's yield for that year to see what they took, cross-compare it again with the Chicago Trade Board to ensure that whichever one's higher, right? So if you got a low yield over here, but Chicago's saying it should have been up here, we're going to try and take care of the larger amount. And then we're going to come to a place where we can expand on that. Mr. Ewan said that they settled on triple for his farm. We like to do that as much as possible. We understand that us being on your property for this period of time is not ideal, especially for the time of year, and we want to do everything in our power to be less intrusive. And then lastly,
Mr. Canapas had a question about he has light flicker.
Oh, yes, sir. Sorry. Got that written down here at the bottom. I would like to, if we could get your information, and myself and Crystal and David, we can meet with you. The folks that were approached for the shadow flicker waivers were the ones that were identified on the violation list that was provided by Epsilon. However, we are not restricting that to just those folks. And we have, there are people that just own homestead within the community that would like to sign up and become a part of this project. We are fully compliant with that. We encourage as many folks as possible to be a member of this project for years to come. So I would ask that before we leave, please get my card or Kimberly, sorry, or Crystal's information, and we'd love to sit down. And that's true for everybody. All right. And I think that was the last question I had written down.
Or since this is still public time, is there any other questions? Does that answer everybody's question? More or less? I see some nods, some, yeah. All right.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. So now is the time for commission discussion. Is there any comments or questions that the commission has before we seek a motion?
I think they were all answered.
I'm not going to say that it was an hour and a half, but we have spent time. I think we've talked about it from every angle. So I guess now would be the time to entertain a motion. I would think, it's been a while, but there, Jerry, could you go back to your slide with your recommendation and the seven?
Would you like me to go through them?
I don't think so. I think the only note from our discussion, which was a while ago, almost an hour ago, was in condition number three, was where we were talking about the resolution of the light flicker agreements and moving forward, and we said that that was not, at least the comments were made, that that wasn't explicit enough about how to move forward. So I think that was the only one of the conditions where we had any additional conversation. So,
and again, for clarification, that last sentence really is focusing on those where they don't have agreements in place, and so they would be requesting to defer action on that
specific tower,
and right. Then come back to the Board of Adjustment at a future date.
Okay.
I'm okay with that.
I am. So we're ready for a motion then.
So motion.
I second.
Okay. So to clarify, the motion is, so we have a motion by Moore and a second by Sherwood to make the, let me make sure I have, I'm going to state it explicitly so that we're clear.
Absolutely.
To use the staff recommendation, including their seven conditions, with the clarification on condition three about explicit towers cannot be upgraded prior to agreements of affected parties.
That was the intent.
All right. So can we have a roll call vote?
Moore.
Aye.
Sherwood.
Aye.
McBride.
Yes.
Moss.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Mins.
Yes.
Okay, so the recommendation will go forward to the Board of Adjustment, who are the official decision makers, to move forward. So...
Fortunately, I think we have one more item in front of you.
Yes, yes, you do. What I'd like to do is take a five-minute break, and then we'll reconvene at, let's say, at a quarter till. That was 8 minutes. It's the farm table.
My farmer gal.
Farm table call to order.
That's right. They hear it then, maybe.
All right. So thank you, everyone, for giving us a break there. Let's move on to discussion and of CUP 06-19. So, Marcus, is this you?
Yes, it is.
Fire away.
All right. So this is in reference to CUP 06-19, the
proposal for a temporary meteorological met tower at the northeast corner of 200th Street and 710th Avenue. This is coming for us. This is in proposal in conjunction with the retrofit for the 100 windmills. So this will be a new conditional use permit. The request is for the installation of a temporary met tower. Temporary for the proposal is for 2 years on the property. This tower will provide performance data for the Story County Wind Energy Center. It will be a total of 267 feet. There will be, with this, and you'll see pictures of this later on, with the style of this, there's no ground disruption that happens. The tower will be placed on a 3.5 foot by 3.5 foot base. It's self-contained, so there'll be no new utilities needed. Little to no noise generation. And right before the meeting, I gave the assessment to everyone from Epsilon show in reference to the noise generation from the Met Tower. And then they also supplied a complete decommissioning agreement signed with the landowner. Again, this is 167-foot tall galvanized tube type tower. So instead of the lattice style, so again, there won't be any risk of any birds being able to roost or anything like that. They will use this tower for the performance testing, again, for the major modification proposed conversion of the 100 existing wind energy conversion systems. On the tower, there will be 7 sensors, including a primary anemometer, control anemometer, 2 wind vanes, a barometer, temperature and relative humidity sensor, and a vertical anemometer. So here's the map. Right here is the parcel for the proposal. Here's the closer of it. It's 3.58 miles northeast of Colo, 4 miles north of Highway 30. It's in the Sherman Township, Section 22. It's a southwest by southwest quarter. Here is a site design laid out from Story County Wind. And as you can see, the tower itself will be almost center north-south and shifted over to the east a little bit. The only other structure on that parcel is a storage bin right here to the south. That's also where the access is to the parcel. So that's where they'll bring the equipment through. The parcel is outside of the 1% annual chance of flood. So this is at the site facing north, facing to the east, across 210th Street to the south, facing west, and then there you can see the bin there. So here is a photo that the applicant supplied to us of how construction of this works. They put it together on the ground, and down here is a base. They use a winch and a truck to then tip it up. As they're tipping it up at certain degrees, they will check the tension to the guy wires to make sure that it's going up vertically and is held stable. As part of the safety requirements, they are going to have fencing around not only the base, but at each of the guy wire anchors points for that, there'll be fencing as well. So then the standards of approval for this conditional use permit, compatibility, communication towers and facilities are permitted as conditional use in A1. If this conditional use permit is granted. The proposed site, as well as the majority of surrounding land, is agricultural row crop, all setback requirements as listed in Chapter 90.86 will be met. So the tower will be located 864 feet east of the 710th Avenue right-of-way, 667 feet north of the 210th Street right-of-way. The nearest dwelling is located over 2,000 feet to the southeast. The monopole structure, we've seen these throughout, do not have climbing apparatuses, and the fencing will also help to alleviate that risk. So in order to install this, all they need is a 3/4-ton pickup to deliver the pieces to the site. Again, there is that entrance right at that grain bin that would be used. Maintenance visits will be rare, only involving a pickup truck with the crew that currently maintains the rest of the site. In parking and loading, while the construction is taking place, all the parking will be on that private property, and there will be no parking or storage on the right-of-way on either of the streets there. So signs and lighting, there are no signs planned for this tower. The Met Tower, because of its height being higher than 200 feet, will have to have lighting on the top for FAA compliance. They have also requested alternating bands of aviation orange and white paint on the tower, high visibility sleeves on the guy wires near the anchor points, and then also high visibility aviation orange spherical markers on the guy wires. As far as environmental protection for the Met Tower, then impact is anticipated to be limited since there's no soil that's moved or turned, just because it's based on that base plate and then guy wires. No environmental will be met harm there. No concrete is used. And then after the term of the lease expires with the property owner, Story County Wind will have all the components of the Met Tower removed and restore the site to its original condition per the decommissioning plan. So then through this analysis, we got to the comments from the review team. This happened on May 2nd, was when the non-bolded questions were brought to light. The applicant has provided answers to all of these. Some of the completed decommissioning plan, along with the safety steps that they've taken with the fencing and sheathing to prevent climbing. And then point eight here has about the decommissioning and the 130%. That's also one of the suggested conditions for the conditional use permit that will be seen here in a minute for that bond. So staff is recommending approval of the conditional use permit application as put forth in case CUP 06-19 with the following conditions: that the Met be located on the subject property for 2 years, and that the performance bond for $21,060 to cover the decommissioning costs shall be submitted and reviewed by the Story County Auditor Attorney's Office prior to application for a zoning permit for the Met. And we are suggesting option two.
Okay. Which is
approved. Oh, sorry. Gotcha. Is there any questions from the commission for staff? No questions? Okay. Now is the time for public comment. If the applicant would like to comment, again, name and address for the record.
Yes, sir. Jeff Wright, 700 Beavers Boulevard, Union Beach, Florida, 34408. Just quickly, the purpose of this Met Tower is goes hand in hand with the maintenance exercise. We spoke a lot about the modeling that we do,
in all of our due diligence and engineering with the site. This is just another measuring equipment to ensure that that modeling is meeting our standards. We proposed it for 2 years, most likely it'll only be there for a year post-construction. But we do go in for the 2 years because we'd like to have it up prior to construction beginning to get some pre and post-construction data to really see what's going on with the site. Other than that, we did speak about the FAA requirements. The FAA did take a look at it and said it does conform with airspace in the area. So they handed a DNH over, which was provided. It does encroach on the 200-foot setback, so it is required to be lit for the FAA, as well as the reflective orange tape around the guy wires and such. Other than that, the Met Tower is fully compliant with state agencies. With that, any questions the board may have?
Nope. All right. Thank you. So now is the time for public comment. If anybody has any questions or comments regarding the conditional use permit for the meteorological tower. Okay. So time for a commission discussion. No, we've talked enough about towers today. All right, so now we're ready to entertain a motion.
I move that we recommend alternative number 2.
I'll second it.
Okay, so we have a motion by Sherwood and a second by Menz. Or is there any discussion about the motion? No? All right. Stephanie, can we get a roll call vote?
Sherwood.
Yes.
Menz.
Yes.
Moore.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
McBride.
Yes.
Moss.
Yes.
All right. So the recommendation goes to this recommendation. Jerry, does this recommendation go to Board of Adjustments,
yes,
or is this
goes to the Board of Adjustment on the 18th?
All right. So probably like this, considered at the same meeting. Okay. Thank you. Let's move on to item 6.3, rezoning 01-19 and subdivision 03-19, Deerfield subdivision. So let's time out for a second.
I couldn't see.
Okay.
Marcus,
oh, no.
All right.
Okay.
I'll just, before you get started, you guys are done, right?
Yeah, we didn't want to be rude.
So,
it's okay.
We'll pause for a moment. We've got more ground to cover. So, okay.
Well,
two hours is probably enough for you guys, so that's fair.
I would just like to say thank you again for your time.
Yes, thank you all very much.
Jerry has all my contact information. I highly encourage you to pass along to your constituents with questions. And,
excellent.
Thank you again for your time.
All right, thank you.
Almost like Florida.
It's a little hotter here.
In June. It's nice.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
you.
Thank you. That's you're the one carrying all the equipment, too.
Well, there's something wrong with that picture.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with that picture.
All right, so we'll go ahead and get started.
Great.
And she can wrap up.
Okay.
Thank you.
So this is a minor subdivision request. It also includes a C2C plan amendment request and a rezoning to allow the minor subdivision as proposed. The applicant is Westwood Center Partners, LC, which is Leon Wupker, who's here tonight. This is in the Ballard Community School District. We did notify the superintendent. Mary Greeley Ambulance and Cambridge Fire. The fire chief provided a letter of acknowledgement. Consumers Energy and Iowa Regional Utilities, which also provided letters confirming their ability to serve the subdivision. And it's in the Sugar Creek South Skunk River watershed and currently zoned A1 agricultural and designated as ag conservation on our C2C future land use map. So the parcel is 27.4 net acres. I'll show you its location, but it is on 560th and 300th Streets, which are gravel county roads. So you can see this is the plat. Here's 300th, and then 560th runs north and south. Three lots are proposed to have frontage on 560th Street. These lots are each 1.51 net acres, and the county engineer has requested a shared access easement between all three lots to cut down on the number of access points off 560th. You can see this gray shaded area is the access easement that they will share. Lot 4 is a corner lot on 560th and 300th. It is 2.5 acres, and the applicant indicates that the intent is for his son to own the lot, who lives just to the south of the proposed subdivision currently. And Adam is also here tonight if you've got questions for him. Outlot A is also part of this subdivision, so it's the remainder of the parcel that will continue to be in agricultural productions. It's very small, but there's a note on the plat that states it's to remain in agricultural production. It will share an access with Lot 4. So while there is frontage on 560th through this little narrow frontage section, it will share an access with Lot 4 where there's an existing drive. But that narrow frontage will allow them to more quickly get onto their property after they've taken access, rather than cutting through all of the back of Lot 4. They have a little narrow arm that they can kind of cut up to from the access. This is the more general location. So we're about a mile from Huxley and Cambridge on the Star, and we're in section 18 of Union Township. Here's some surrounding land use. So this parcel was actually created when first 300th Street split the parcel, and then a subdivision was done to the south that currently has five lots. Later in 2008, the parcel was further divided once to create the subject property and a remainder, and the remainder was then platted as a four-lot subdivision. It's zoned AR Ag Residential, which is the zoning request the applicant has requested tonight. Other surrounding land use, it's mainly A1 agricultural parcels within a quarter mile, but there are a number of other agricultural residential zoned parcels in Brown. That's Dream Lake, if you're familiar with the area. It has several lots on it with dwellings. And then there's two other subdivisions to the south of Dream Lake that are about exactly half a mile away that are also zoned ag residential. So the area is a denser residential area with this ag residential zoning district that allows a minimum lot size of 1 acre. So it's still a larger lot size that the zoning district allows. So of the land within half a mile, there's 63 total parcels, and 28, which is a little less than half, actually contain single family dwellings. The average lot size is 5.5 net acres. And I also wanted to point out that along Dream Lake here, and some of the other lot lines that you're kind of seeing on this picture, are related to the original platting of this section. There's a fair amount of wood lots, which are these lots that were platted around the same time as we had aliquot parts divided out, that were to provide wood for fuel and building to early farm families that settled Story County. These lots are considered legal non-conforming lots of record, so they may be built upon regardless of size, which is related to why we have a higher density of residential uses in this area, because we have, if you look at the picture on the right, this is the about 1952 and prior platting of the area. You have all of these more dense lots already created with the original platting of this section. Here are some site photos. This is looking north on 560th. This is looking northeast from the subject property on lot 3 and lot 2. So this is looking east in the subject property. You can see this part, a house in the subdivision located adjacent here. This is looking southeast on 560th. So you can see another house in the subdivision to the south across 300th here. This is looking east more onto proposed lot 4, which is that corner lot. And you, again, you can see some of the dwellings in the adjacent subdivision. This is a view of the corner of 560th and 300th. Again, the corner, but now we're looking northwest. This is actually a dwelling in another subdivision that has two lots across the street. Looking northeast, again, from the corner onto proposed lot 4 in the outlot. And again, looking east from the corner. And this is looking northwest onto the subject property from across 300, so you can see this, there's a small treed area on proposed lot 4. And this is looking east down 300, closer to the, this other adjacent subdivision. And looking west. And again, looking west, so you can see down 300th from the corner with 560th. So I'm going to do the C2C plan amendment standards first, which is, our future land use plan. It's ag conservation currently, and it's requested to be rural residential to more closely match with the proposed subdivision. So the first standard is we look at the extent to which the change would be consistent with the comprehensive plan goals and policies. There's a number of goals and policies. Just a general summary would be to preserve farmland, agricultural resources, ensure land use transitions are gradual and designed to reduce potential incompatibilities. Those are some of the agricultural resource goals for this C2C plan. We are only proposing with this subdivision to have 7 acres approximately be development lots. The remaining 20 would be an outlot that will continue to be farmed. So that's approximately 25% of the subject property that would be taken out of production. The subject property, however, does have a low land evaluation and site assessment score, which is one part is allowing is a standard for the rezoning as well, so we did calculate it. And it is lower because of the, you know, surrounding land uses, locational factors lower that score, making it less, showing that it's less prime for agricultural production. The design of the subdivision also clusters the lots with frontage on an existing road rather than creating a new road and fragmenting the farmland further. We also have policies for housing, providing a range of housing types that meet existing needs and forecasted demands for Story County residents. So in this area, the C2C plan did an assessment of growth in the county. Huxley experienced from 1990 to 2010 the highest level of growth in Story County, 62% increase in population. Cambridge also experienced a 16.1% increase in population. Overall, the unincorporated area of, this, of Story County decreased, but these two cities that are closest did see an increase. Looking at the unincorporated development in these areas, though, in Palestine Township and Union Township since 2015, we've only had 4 new development lots created in each township in the unincorporated area, mainly through only through residential parcel subdivisions, where you have an existing dwelling and you create one more development lot, maybe for a family member, maybe just to keep an ag production, which is the case in some of these. So we really haven't seen many new lots created despite, you know, the growth of this area and the unincorporated area. So related to meeting the existing housing needs and forecasted demand, you know, part of this is rural residential housing. Folks do want to live, you know, outside of a city on a larger lot. And so that is another housing goal, to provide densities that reinforce the predominantly rural character of the area. Again, the development lots are at an average of 1.7 net acres in size, but with the outlot, the subdivision is approximately 5.5 net acres of average lot size, which is the same as the average for a parcel within a quarter mile that has a dwelling. So it is reflective of the existing density of the area if you include that outlot in that will be preserved for agricultural production. Other goals include considering the availability of local services and infrastructure, which we already went through. We've, you know, communicated with utility providers and the fire department. Evaluate long and short-term fiscal impacts to the county budget. The county engineer also noted that 560th does get frequent complaints because of traffic with more residential uses in that area. And so they want it to have a note placed on the plat to inform future buyers that the road will not be paved. So there won't be a financial cost to the county, and that note may be placed on the plat. If it's not placed on the plat, we'll put it in the resolution or the ordinance that the Board of Supervisors would adopt to ensure that folks are informed that there's no plans to pave this road. Evidence, the next standard is have evidence demonstrating the reasons why the plan should be changed from ag conservation to rural residential. Staff just wanted to note that it is an item on our work program as part of the C2C plan implementation matrix to establish location guidelines for proposed subdivisions. You know, the C2C plan didn't really look at adjacent subdivisions or, you know, historically denser areas when they designated ag conservation areas or rural residential areas. It was, you know, mainly based on the tax classification of parcels. This is something that we're going to be working on, and we will likely consider adjacency to other residential zoning districts and subdivisions. And so this proposal would likely, you know, meet those locational guidelines for proposed subdivisions once we get to that work program item.
Amelia, is that trying to maybe more closely align the how things are typically classified closer to like the LISA scoring, right? How it looks at several different components, not just
that could be part of
street
it too.
Usage.
Uh-huh. And just making sure that we're not, you know, fragmenting areas that are, you know, majority ag land for subdivisions, not putting subdivisions where there aren't any services or infrastructure, maybe putting them closer to cities and other already developed areas.
All right.
Whether or not the change in the C2C plan is needed to allow reasonable development of the site, staff found that it is. You could put one dwelling on the site right now, but then you would, after being built, have to go through a subdivision process to get one additional lot. And really, the surrounding land uses, when they're compared to this site, have allowed for folks to do, you know, more than just two lots. They've allowed for typically four or more lots. So when compared to the surrounding area, you know, this change is needed to allow reasonable development of the site. The relationship with the proposed amendment to supply and demand, we've already talked about, you know, growth in the vicinity of the subject property, so I'm not going to go into that again. But I did also want to point out that the C2C plan did, you know, a housing demand projection, and they said that 346 new single-family dwellings and 314 new multifamily dwellings were needed per year. Which is above the average housing starts typical for Story County in the past 30 years. We looked at permits since 2015. In Palestine Township, there were, 14 permits for dwellings and dwelling additions, and in Union Township, there were 12 permits for dwellings and dwelling additions in the unincorporated area, but still this isn't, you know, so high compared to demand. And finally, a demonstration that the proposed amendment has merit beyond the interests of the applicant. They are preserving ag land, but also providing additional opportunities for housing. So while, you know, this would allow them to plat and sell the lots, they are meeting a housing need and conserving ag at the same time. The possible impacts of the amendment. We're also supposed to review potential impacts to all elements of the comprehensive plan. I'm just going to touch on two, economic prosperity. We do have a really low unemployment rate in Story County, and related to a tight labor market can be issues attracting new workers, including a shortage of housing. And transportation, we've already touched on this, but the proposed designation amendment will likely have a limited impact, allowing up to four new dwellings in the area. Lot 4 may not have a dwelling on it since it will be owned by the applicant's son and he may use it for farming and garden purposes. But the county engineer has addressed this by requiring those changes in the accesses to have shared access easements and putting a note on the subdivision that there will be no paving of 560th in the near future. And no fiscal impacts are anticipated related to those transportation notes. So standards of approval for a rezoning. Again, this rezoning shall conform to the C2C plan. That's why we went through the C2C plan standards before this. But also just the general vicinity. In yellow are rural residential designated areas in the surrounding area. The subject property is ag conservation. It would, you know, be fitting for the area to have this designated rural residential as well. The proposed rezoning shall conform to the statement of intent for the district. The ag residential district is intended to provide detached dwellings interrelated with agricultural activities, but not to permit isolated dwellings. So not to have a rezoning that would just create one new lot for a dwelling in the middle of an A1 district. And so that's not the case here. We do have adjacent agricultural residential district zoning, as well as 28 dwellings within a half mile. And we do have an outlot, so there is an agricultural use that's part of this subdivision as well. Being compatible with surrounding land uses, I feel like we've gone through this one already. There's no natural resources on the property. There's a small portion, but it's due to an inaccuracy in the mapping. You know how we're working on the natural areas maps. This is one of those where there's a square that is on a piece of land that's in row crop production. So it's an inaccuracy. And then the LISA score is under 267. It's 237. All requirements for minor subdivisions are met. And the interagency review team waived a requirement that contours be shown on the plat because we have available contours through LIDAR that we can use. Comments included those from the engineer that we've discussed. Margaret with Environmental Health just noted that with subdivisions, the soil site review must be conducted by a professional engineer. So that'll be something that will be submitted with any septic application for the new dwellings. And we also noted that if an area of over 1 or more acres is disturbed while the subdivision is developing, an NPDES permit for stormwater discharge from the DNR is required. We mailed comments to property owners within a quarter mile of the subdivision. I did provide you with a copy of one comment from an adjacent property owner with some concerns. The concerns very closely aligned with the standards for the subdivision, including long-term effects on road maintenance, rural water supply, and traffic patterns. Looking at the demand for development in the area. And then there was another question about what type of dwellings would be permitted. And there are not covenants proposed, so I will provide that additional detail. The city of Huxley will take action on the request on June 11th as a city within 2 miles, and the city of Cambridge has acted on the request and approved it. They acted on June 3rd, so Monday. So with that, you may take action separately on all of these requests, or you may take action on everything at once. Staff is recommending alternative one, which is approval of all three requests. Any questions for me?
I had a question about the outlot.
Mm-hmm.
It says that it's going to remain in agricultural use, right? Remain in row crop. And I saw that there was it's essentially like a flag lot, right? There's just basically a narrow path in.
Yeah.
Right. So near the bottom left there, that's the access to the row crop. Mm-hmm. I guess my question is, yeah, for now it's going to remain in agricultural use, but in the future, if it was, depending on how they developed it, is that strip in between there, is that, I mean, if, I know there's a lot of what ifs here, so just bear with me for a second, but if they decided to do that as a subdivision, not, you know, of more than four lots, mm-hmm. and they needed to put a public access road in, is that strip wide enough to support a public access road?
Yeah, it is. But I think the bigger question would be if the separation distance is met between like existing driveways and that
right.
corner. Huh?
Is that the new ordinance that you're...
The 300-foot minimum.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
That we went through.
Yeah, it's always been 300-foot. We just codified it. So to put a new road in there, I think there
it would be an
there's
exception.
Clearly
right.
site distance and separation distance issues already okay. in this corner.
So right now what they're planning on doing is making basically one drive
right.
and then splitting it basically north and south.
Yeah.
To,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
But it is wide enough.
Can you point?
Huh?
Is there, do you have a pointer?
Yeah.
Can you point to where the access is?
It's right at the corner. And so there's a shared access easement here. So you'd come in at the corner if you were the farmer and just go up here to the drive and across to the field. And then this is the other shared access easement for the other lots that will have a similar.
What is the access to the road?
That'll be on lot two.
So on lot two, they'll have essentially a driveway to the road that will branch off going north to lot one and south to lot three.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll share one road access. And my question is, as you look at that outlot, and if they were going to develop that further, then it would likely require a public road. And is that access gap mm-hmm. wide enough to support a public road just in the future?
It's just a question of the location
okay.
is appropriate.
Can you explain that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you're siting like a new road, like a driveway, there's separation distances between existing roads and driveways required just so you have adequate site distance to make sure you can safely turn off the road or out of your driveway. There is in this area as well. It's hilly on lot four on 300. The topography does drop to the southeast. And then there are site distance issues related to topography as 300th Street or 560th rises to the north of the subdivision as well. So that's part of why we have these shared access easements as well. But you know, an outlot, we cannot issue a zoning permit on an outlot. It's supposed to be reserved for preservation purposes or a future subdivision. But that is indicated that it is to remain tillable ag land on the plat.
Remain till what?
To remain tillable ag land is
okay,
what it says.
Tillable ag. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a little fuzzy, I guess.
It's okay.
Wait a minute, that... remaining till that's not a legally binding statement at all,
mm-hmm.
correct? I mean, is it a statement of intent by the landowner, or is it just kind of a...
trying to keep preserved farm ground to continue
yeah.
that use?
They being the owner.
Yeah. I think when we look at notes on plats, for instance, the common one is no further divisions permitted. To get a note like that on a plat removed would probably take consent from all the owners in the subdivision, as well as maybe a resolution.
I just wondered in general.
Yeah, I think if the commission is concerned, you could place a condition on the rezoning. That the outlet A, while it's being rezoned to ag residential, is not for future subdivision purposes. So that would be alternative two.
So from now on, do we have to put the road is not going to be paved on every subdivision?
No, just this one because of the number of complaints about the road.
If you live in the country, it's not paved.
Yeah. So we're just trying to inform.
Apparently in this area, there's interest in moving toward a hard surface road.
From.
That's not something that's...
There's lots of interest in a lot of gravel roads. So.
Yeah. Well, these five people would love to have a paved road.
Assessments. I don't want mine paved. They'd go 100 mile an hour. People.
Is that...
I'm good. You answered my question. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. The applicant's also here. So.
All right. Are there any other questions? No? All right. Thank you, Amelia. Now's the time for public comment. So if you'd like to comment on the proposed...
The applicant first.
Proposed
Sorry.
Changes, the applicant. All right. So if the applicant would like to address us... Mm-hmm. Please step to the podium. Give us your name and address for the record, please.
Leon Webb for 6723 Highway 69, Ames. When we bought this, we liked what we saw there with the other three houses, four houses, five houses in a row, and that's just what we're trying to replicate. I own a moving company. We move people all the time. A lot of people want to have a building where they can have a small business, park the truck at night, have some animals, raise a small garden or whatever, and that's what we're trying to replicate here. And I think that's what the existing four houses in that area are doing also. My son lives right across the road, and I know there's a lot of questions about the outlet. As far as I'm concerned, he's going to be taken over someday, and he wants ag land out there. So if that satisfies that part of the question. I thank you, Amelia, for doing a very thorough presentation. I don't have anything to say unless somebody has a question.
Does the commission have any questions for the applicant?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you, sir.
My turn?
Public comment?
Sure.
All right, name and address. Name and address.
Adam Webker, 56122 300 Street. So, like I said, this is my dad, so I can deal with Ms. McBride over there. I'm getting a little fuzzy as well. I said through all that earlier, so I'll make it quick. But I guess I've lived there for 8 years, just right across the street. This was an opportunity that came along, and my dad was in the position to buy it. But since I've been there, like two or three of those other Deerfield houses have been built. Great neighbors. You know, we love the area. In fact, I actually just we're moving in on Friday, just remodeled my house to a bigger tax base. You know, I have a family. This outlot is going to be an additional area for me. I have ag ground on my ground across the street, and this is just going to be a continuation for us. But it's a great area, and I have some, when I first presented it to my dad, about the opportunity to buy this. I had several friends, you know, at different times that have been looking for an acreage like this. In Story County, it's high demand. You know, if a house comes up, a house or an acreage comes on the market, it's gone, you know, that day. I've had some friends looking real hard, so just wanted to have the possible opportunity to give someone else, friend, family, possibly others, the opportunity to be in an area that we love so much that, you know, would go along with this whole area as well. And then I guess just throw a couple notes, not a very helpful speaker for you guys, but just ask the board's approval to look favorably on this request and be grateful. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, so are there any public comments? Any questions or comments from any members of the public? No? All right, so now it's time for commission discussion. Any questions or comments? Discussions? All right, and then we're open for a motion.
I'd move that we approve based on alternative number one.
Second. Okay, so we have a motion by Moore and a second by McBride. Can we have a roll call vote?
Moore.
Aye.
McBride.
Yes.
Sherwood.
Yes.
Mins.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Moss.
Yes.
All right, so the recommendation goes forward to Board of Adjustment and Board of Supervisors, both, or 18th? Just Board of Supervisors?
Just Supervisors.
All right.
On the 18th.
All right. Okay, so getting close to the end. Moving on to item 6.4, CUP 4.14-19, City of Ames well discussion.
This is the last item. I want to thank Neil Weiss with the City of Ames for his patience. This is CUP 04-19. It's owned, the property is owned by the City of Ames. It's in Section 36, Township 8424. It's in the unincorporated area of the county. This is a project that involves three total wells. One of these happens to be in the unincorporated area of the county. And so our ordinance for public water supply facilities requires a conditional use permit. And so that's why the city submitted this application. Property is zoned A1 agriculture, and a part of it's actually zoned R1 transitional district, the east portion. The well water head will be constructed in the portion of the parcel that's in an A1 district. You can actually do a project like this in either district, but it will be constructed in the A1 district. Properties currently or previously was in row crops. It is located within the 100-year floodplain. This is typically where you would do a project like this, you know, where the water table is available. The area is in the Ames River Fringe. It's designated natural area and rural residential. It's contiguous to the City of Ames. Project scope is the, again, City of Ames currently has 22 water well supplies that produce a lot of water, 2.2 billion gallons per year. This is on their project plan number 29. It will produce about 88 million gallons of water a year is what they're projecting. The proposed well will be operated remotely from the City of Ames water plant on 13th Street to the south and east of this project. The well is approximately 120 feet. All three wells are approximately that deep. A few are a little deeper than that. Again, it's located within the 100-year floodplain. The wellhead, though, will be elevated above the base flood elevation. We have a requirement that it be elevated at least a foot and a half. It'll exceed that by several feet. And we have a profile drawing that we can show you. The base of the wellhead will have an 8-foot high chain link fence for security purposes. Estimated project cost around $5.6 million. This shows you the location, thank you, of the project. So the area that we're looking at is right here. This is the one that is the wellhead that would be in the unincorporated area of the county. There's a wellhead proposed to the north and to the west. Those two are actually inside the City of Ames. And the water plant is to the south and east on 13th Street. Property is 2.81 acres. Again, it was in agricultural row crops. The footprint of this improvement is 0.05 acres. Will be impacted. It will be centrally located on the parcel about 200 feet from the east and west property line. We did a site review. We had rain, I think, the day before. There was some standing water there. So likely when they get going on this with our weather, it'll likely be dry. But it is in the floodplain, so that's perfectly is, you know, what is expected. Surrounding sand, land use, much of the surrounding land consists of natural areas, woods, ag land, scattered dwellings. Closest dwelling is to the east of this project, about 580 feet from the proposed wellhead. And then to the south of that property is the Isaac Walton League. And there's a parcel there. To the north, east, and west, it's a 32-acre parcel containing row crops. There's some outbuildings. There is no dwelling. To the south, 54 acres is the land that makes up the North River Valley Park. And so, but the Skunk River does extend through it, but there is an access off Stagecoach Road, which is what they're planning to get to this site. It's a dirt road access. There's a gate that I believe is locked, restricting access to the general public. There's actually tree lines, full mature trees on the north and the south side of that drive extending in also. As I mentioned, it is in the floodplain. Because it's in the floodplain, they're required to apply for a floodplain permit. Our process involves the applicant going through the CUP process first before they request the floodplain permit, which they're aware of. The Ames Water Pollution Control Department did receive response from the Iowa DNR with regard to wildlife. They reviewed it. They provide a reference to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife resources. There's a website, a link that you can go to, and they identified a few species, and they didn't do a field review, so they indicated that this is something that should be monitored. They identify an Indiana bat, northern long-haired, bat, rusty-patched bumblebee is typically in this area. And so this is something that the applicant will communicate with their contractor, and it will be monitored. So this just shows you profile of the proposed well. It's the one in the center. Again, it's 120 foot depth. And then this is the wellhead. The red arrow just shows you the base flood elevation. This is represents the grade, the wellhead structure. And so they're going to be at least 2 feet above this. They're calling it a repair clamp. And then this is like a platform, which is several feet above that. Again, we look at the five issues: compatibility. Property was acquired by the City of Ames for the water wellhead project. You typically locate these in areas where it's low, close to river streams, where there's an abundance of underground water supply, which is the case here. This type of infrastructure would not be out of character. Transition, probably from the view to the south, with the trees that are along that drive that goes into the parkland, it's kind of hard to see through it, but from the north, it will be seen. But that's part of, for security reasons, I think they want to make sure that it's easily seen when they're doing a drive past. Again, the compound of the wellhead will be enclosed with a chain link fence to prevent unauthorized entry. Traffic, very minimal. I think staff will monitor. They're going to do a lot of monitoring from their facility on 13th Street, but they'll likely go to the site once a month. Parking, probably one truck, one vehicle during that time. There's ample space on that 2.8 acre parcel to do that. No signs or lighting are planned. Project has been, with regard to environmental protection, project has been reviewed and received approval from the Iowa DNR. They have a 404 permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Applicant will meet the Iowa DNR requirements during and after the construction of the well for erosion control, so they have to get a permit for that as well. There's no excess noise will be generated with one trip a month, and then the mechanism that drives the pump will be an electric motor. The design meets the American Water Works Association criteria, and it's being professionally designed. Their engineer is HDR, and they will maintain the grass by mowing it. So these are site photos. This is looking to the south from Stagecoach Road. You can see there is some standing water. This is the access going in. We're looking to the west. You can see the gate here. Get a little closer. This is that clearing that you saw. And so the wellhead will likely be toward the center. Kind of looks like a pond right now. Closed access or restricted access. And this is looking to the south, down Stagecoach Road. This is looking to the north from that access. These are additional items that the Planning and Zoning Commission and the Board of Adjustment are to consider. We did provide that those responses in our staff report. I'd be happy to address them if you have questions. We had a conceptual review on the 23rd of May. Applicant was submitted on the 24th. It was routed, reviewed by the staff here. We had several questions that the applicant was quick to provide responses to. Engineering secondary roads, there's a drainage area. This project also involves construction of water main communication lines. And so they had a comment. There's a drainage tile that, you know, try to avoid that with their construction if possible. If it's encountered, make sure that it's fixed. And the applicant indicated that they would take care of that. We did send notices to property owners within a quarter mile. Also, City of Ames and Gilbert on May 29 regarding the conditional use permit application, and we received no responses. So, again, similar points that we raised during the first two conditional use permits. Number three, the site for the project strategically located over the Ames Aquifer. So this is where they want to be. They've studied it, this is where the source water is. And it's the goal is really to provide source water so that they don't need to rationings during dry periods of the year. And again, they did obtain the 404 permit, Iowa DNR permit, and then the site was actually reviewed by the DNR, and they approved the location of all three sites for each well. So that brings us to the recommendation, which is approval straight up with regard to the application, which again is CUP04-19. And again, the applicant is here, and I want to thank him for his patience.
All right. Are there any questions for staff?
Is that parcel already owned by the city, Jerry?
Yes, it is.
And is that in the, I mean, I know where that field is. It's essentially east of Ada Hayden and west and north a little bit of Isaac Walton, right?
Yeah, we're in kind of eastern Ames. It's contiguous to the city's corporate limits.
Okay. So it's, yeah, frequently when we get good rain, looks like that.
So it'd be right here is where the project site is. Mm-hmm. And the treatment plant's right down here on 13th Street.
So if 24th Street were extended east, that's what it would be.
Right.
It looked like it was in row. Okay. It was in row crops. I don't know if they put in the crops yet.
Okay.
If they did, it was looked like no-till.
So now's the opportunity then for the applicant to address the commission, if you're here or would like to. City of Ames, if any comments or?
My name is Neil Weiss. I'm an engineer at the City of Ames Water Plant. Just wanted to thank Jerry for his help with this process and going through that detailed report. It was kind of we're trying to speed up the construction, so it was kind of fast-paced, and Jerry was a lot of help throughout the process. So I'm here to answer any questions that any of you have. Other than that, it was a pretty detailed PowerPoint already about it.
There's also a lot of good information in the
staff report.
In the application and things online too, if you want to look at it. One thing I would point out is my initial concern when I was looking at it was related to, you know, drawdown of aquifers, and it's highlighted in the information that the pumps are designed and with the majority, you know, having the number that you do so that they're only running up to, like, I think the target is 25% of the time so that the aquifers refill, replenish. All right. Is there any additional public comment or anyone that would like to comment? You're it. I'm looking at you because it's not really it. He's already had his turn.
We're just interested in
okay.
You guys live up in that house that's up in the woods?
Yes.
Okay.
That beautiful, calm, peaceful, wonderful yep. house. Yeah.
Yep. I'd say that was Nixon Lauritsen's house, wasn't it?
No, we,
no,
built,
we
it.
Built it.
Oh, did you? Okay.
All right, excellent. So now is the time for commission discussion. Or lack of discussion indicating we're ready for a motion?
I move that we consider staff recommendation number one.
And again, this also goes to the Board of Adjustment on the 19th.
Okay, so we have a motion by Menz. Do we have a second? We have a second by Sherwood. Is there any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, let's move forward with a roll call vote.
Menz.
Yes.
Sherwood.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Moss.
Yes.
McBride.
Yes.
Moore.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That concludes staff business and public business.
Yeah, I don't know that I mentioned. We do have an intern also, Gabriel Nelson, who's a graduate student at Iowa State, and he was actually in the audience. I didn't see him. I wasn't sure if he came up or not, but he's been helping us out a great deal also, hasn't he?
Excellent.
And so this is our busy time, so it's nice to have an intern. And
it is,
and
it is the busy
back.
Time, and with Marcus being new and
full steam.
Amelia having to do all the real work, Jerry.
I had two cases. I want the for the record to show that right. I worked on two cases.
Yeah, we know who drives the car and takes the pictures.
Thank you, Marlon.
No problem, Jerry. Is there any staff comments?
That's all I have for you.
Any commission comments? I have one comment or question, really, and I think I've brought it up before, and I don't remember the answer. So my question is about the communication tower on the IDOT lot.
We looked into that, and it was noted that their plan was to remove the existing one, but it wasn't actually
we didn't
condition
get
the
deadline or condition, right?
And I think when Emily was here, she contacted them to find out, you know, about it, and they're using it still. So because it really wasn't
a condition
to be removed within so many days,
there's no enforceability.
I think their intention is to remove it because the other tower has been constructed.
They built that new one specifically to I don't know if there's a way to have a discussion with them and say it may not be codified, but you came to us with the intention of replacing this one, and you're not replacing it.
Right. We could request something in writing from them on their plans. Would that be helpful? And then we could just present that to
them. Then we have at least something that's actionable because we didn't do a good enough job the first time. Honestly, I mean, I remember being part of that.
Yeah, that was a part of our recommendation that one was, you know, and we were told it was going to go away.
On Highway 30, between here and 35.
By Brecky's, right?
On the north side of the road is the IDOT. There's an IDOT
right.
facility. And they have a communication tower in the front of the property, and they have a new communication tower in the rear of the property. So they came to us and wanted to rebuild the front, but it didn't meet the setback for distance from the road because they were building a taller one. And actually, I don't think that existing one met the current standards, and so we remanded it back to them. They came back and said, okay, we found another location on the property near the back, and we'll do that. And I thought we had the condition or the recommendation that this one replaces this one goes away. Mm-hmm. And that was at least 2 years ago.
That's how it was presented.
And so the intention was, we're going to replace this one with this one, and now they have two.
Right. Well, it must be on the same schedule as the flyway.
Shots fired. Okay.
I do have something else to say. The next meeting is not...
It's not the
it's
third.
The second week
it's
in July,
not the
July
third,
10th.
It's the 10th. So we shifted to the second Wednesday because it's the third. Well, because according to Ames, the 4th of July is on the 3rd.
In this one case only.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. Because of the holiday.
That should be in your agenda
schedule.
Yeah.
10th.
It
right?
is. I just had it on my calendar, and so I brought it up, and now they're clarifying, so I don't show up on the 3rd.
Well, yeah, I would.
So, anyway.
Thank you.
With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Three best words in English language. Okay.